Thank you so much. Could have been like a movie introduction. So thanks very much for having me. I'm super happy to be here. So I'm going to talk about our more or less recent work, or actually two more or less recent works that we did together with a bunch of people. So my PhD advisor, Zebi Huber at ETH, Eliska, and then Netanel and Eris from Technion and Weizmann. So I'm going to talk about basically two parts. One is both are related to variational wave functions. And in the first part, I'll talk about how to enhance the ansatz in bringing together physical insights about the system and neural networks to get more accurate wave functions. And then the second part of my talk, I'm going to look at using variational wave functions to get some insights beyond lattice models. So let's start. I'm going to give a broad overview. So what we're to define the problem, what we're looking at is the quantum many-body problem. So what do we have? We have a many-body Hamiltonian, and we want to obtain a wave function that is associated to it, which can be like, in general, you know, a time-evolved wave function or an eigenstate or whatnot. And here we're going to look at ground states. And as we all are aware is that we have a problem, right? So the problem comes with the scaling of the system. If we have n spins, then our Hilbert space size scales as 2 to the n. So we cannot do exact diagonalization beyond a certain lattice size, which means we need different methods. And one solution to this problem that we can think about is saying, okay, we have this huge Hilbert space, but we're actually not looking to just get any arbitrary state in this Hilbert space, but we're looking at a very specific submanifold of the Hilbert space containing ground states of physical Hamiltonians. And then the hope is that to parameterize the submanifold, we only need a polynomial or at least not exponential amount of parameters. And just to recap, so if we have this parameterization, how do we get to the ground state energy? Well, what we can do is we say, okay, we have our wave function psi or our ground state that we want to approximate. And we expand it in basis functions, which can be, for example, spin configuration, but it can also be something different. And then what we do is we parameterize these complex amplitudes with something. And that's then our wave function ansatz. And then we make use of the variational principle in minimizing the expectation value of the Hamiltonian to get an approximation of the ground state energy. Now, variational wave functions have been around for a long time, and they started out very physically motivated with wave functions with only a very limited amount of parameters, where each parameter had like a physical meaning. And there are like famous examples for that. Here I put the resonating valence bond wave function by Phil Anderson, used for example for spin liquids, and there are a lot of sophisticated approaches that have been introduced over time. And these wave functions brought great physical insights, but they come with a limited amount of variational freedom. Then there is this great class of powerful tensor network methods that I'm not going to get into. They have different limitations, which are entanglement and dimensionality. And then more recently, a generic class of wave functions has been introduced, which are neural network wave functions. And these wave functions are very flexible. But they are, however, not physically motivated, so it can, in some cases, become difficult to obtain an accurate approximation. Just to give a short overview, so neural network quantum states have been now around for a while, and they come in all different architectures. So it started out with a restricted Boltzmann machine, then there are like deep convolutional neural networks and recurrent neural networks that are like geographically close. And what I'm going to use in this talk, because it's a simple example, and because it was suitable for the system that we looked at, is the restricted Boltzmann machine. But I want to stress that, in theory, our results could be extended to different architectures. So, what's a restricted Boltzmann machine? Well, it consists of two layers, a visible layer and a hidden layer. And the visible layer takes as input a spin configuration. And the parameters lie in the weights and biases of the hidden and visible neurons and in the connections between them. And then these weights and biases go into the energy functional. And by summing over all possible values of the hidden neurons, we get an ansatz for our variation wave function. Okay, now let's say you have such an RBM, and you want to find a ground state wave function, and your RBM spans a certain submanifold of the Hilbert space. And you say, okay, well, my ground state is still kind of far away from that. What can I do to make it better? And for RBMs, there is a very generic way to do so. You just increase the amount of hidden neurons. However, that's in no way connected to the model. It's not physically motivated. And it's not clear if you're, there's no reason why you should directly go in the direction of the ground state. You could be unlucky and expand your Hilbert space in a different direction. And what we thought about is how can we bring a little bit more of physical intuition into this expansion of the Hilbert space. So can we somehow tune the model, the neural network to the model to bring a bit more direction to the Hilbert space expansion? And what we thought about how doing that are correlations of the system. So let's go back to our RBM. Our idea is a very simple one, which is instead of just increasing the amount of hidden neurons, you put additional visible neurons with values that are determined by relevant correlations of the system. So they are just products of spins, and which products of spins you input depends on the model. And then these visible neurons come with their own biases and weights, and they go into the energy functional, so you have a Hilbert space extension, which might go into a different direction. So, having stated that and said that, let's see a bit how this actually works on an example. And I'll use the example of a topological model, the toric code in the presence of magnetic fields. Now, toric code model, as a reminder for everybody, what is it again? Well, we have a lattice with spin 1/2 degrees of freedom on the edges. And the Hamiltonian consists of these so-called stabilizer operators, which are these vertex operators and these placket operators. And what's special about it is that they mutually commute. So we can write down the ground state as an eigenstate of all of these stabilizer operators. And then this ground state is topologically protected, and people are thinking of the toric code in connection to quantum error correction, quantum memory, etc. Now, what you can ask is, okay, what happens if you put some magnetic fields? And people have been looking at this for a long time in all different field directions and so on and so on. There are some mappings that you can do in some field directions. What we're going to look at is all field directions and see whether we can recover the whole phase diagram of the toric code. Okay, before I come to how like an RBM performs, let me first detail a bit about how to input correlators into this ansatz. So let's have a look at this lattice. And let's think about what is relevant in this model. And you could say a very generic, like zeroth order thing to do, which actually is not really model specific, is to say, well, let's just say we want a bit more flexibility with respect to representing correlations. Why don't we input a bond correlation? You can do that. It brings actually some improvement to the ansatz, but it's not like the big thing that changes everything. So you can go and say, well, we actually do know something about this model. We know it has this very specific form that it's the ground state without any magnetic fields is an eigenstate to all of these stabilizer operators. So why don't we input stabilizer operators, the ones that we can input with our basis? And okay, this we do. And then just as an additional detail, the toric code ground state is four-fold degenerate. and differs by topological sectors, and these differ by non-contractible loops. And in order to get flexibility with respect to that, we also input non-contractible loops. Okay, that's the ansatz. Let's do that, and let's see how it performs. So that's the standard RBM without any correlators for a small lattice where you can do exact diagonalization, for a field direction, the one in y direction. And that's the exact ground state, and that's the RBM. And it continues to look like this if you increase the amount of it in neurons. So it doesn't perform great. Now, if you input the correlators, things get much better. And if you want to, this is not only the case for the Y fields, but also for different field directions. So here I put as an example a different field direction and the relative error, so that you can see, get an impression of the order of magnitude. And what we see is that introducing these correlators, or the case of the toric-coded model, improves the precision by several orders of magnitude. Okay, so that's exact diagonalization. Of course, if you want the phase diagram, you want to scale it up. So that's what we did. We scaled it up. We compared the results to some limits in perturbation theory, and using topological quantities like Wilson loops and fidelity overlap, we could recover the phase diagram of the toric code. So with this, let me actually, that was very fast, let me summarize the first part of the correlated RBM talk. I will introduce a different model now, but we're able to, by looking at the toric code model and understanding the physics of the model, were able to improve the precision by several orders of magnitude. Now we can ask the question, okay, that's for topological order, for a very specific model. Can we also get some improvement for different types of models? And for this, yes?
So can you write down, so without magnetic field and so on, can you get the ground state of the toric code just with the products? And no hidden units, or
No. You do need at least one hidden unit.
With the input.
So without magnetic fields, there is an exact toric code representation without any correlators with one hidden unit. If you use correlators, I think you still need one hidden unit. So yeah. Okay. So. With this, let's look at the second model, the Heisenberg model on the triangular lattice. What is it? Well, we have the Heisenberg Hamiltonian consisting of this product of spin operators with anti-ferromagnetic coupling. And it's defined on the triangular lattice, which induces frustration. And this means that the classical Neel order is unstable with respect to quantum flux. And this frustration introduces two types of sign problem, if you want. One is the quantum Monte Carlo sign problem of sampling over non-positive amplitudes. And the other one is what people kind of call the variational Monte Carlo sign problem, because you have a wave function with non-trivial sign structure, which makes the optimization difficult. So let's see how we perform on such a challenging model. And if you look at a different model, of course, you need to think about different correlators to include into your ansatz. And what we're thinking about was that there's a very early paper about the Heisenberg model by Hughes and Elsa. And they had a wave function, which was basically just a gesture factor, having like single spin, two spin correlators, and three-body correlators of this type. And they showed, and nothing else, it was just an exponential. And they showed that including especially these correlators helped to improve the precision by quite a lot. So we thought, okay, you know, we kind of are a combination of a gesture factor and some hidden connection which makes it non-trivial. So let's try the same thing. And what we found is that, so here you see the blue line is the standard RBM without any additional correlators and whatnot. as a function of the number of parameters. And the green line is this correlated RBM with including these correlators. And what we see is that it's not like as striking as in the case of the Tory code, but there is like a relevant gain in precision, which we didn't push it, like that's a 6 times 6 lattice, but in theory it means there could be an improvement for also different types of systems if you push it to larger lattices. So with this, let me conclude the first part. So what we did is that we capitalized on the physical intuition by thinking about what are relevant correlators of the system. And by including these correlators to the neural network wave functions, we could obtain highly accurate ground states. What I didn't talk about is that we also looked at excited states and different methods to obtain excited states with variational Monte Carlo. And we could also recover phase transitions from that, but that's all I'm going to say about it. And that we're able to apply it to a few models. So.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So you mentioned this analogy, what would you call it, the VMC sign problem?
Yes.
So how does the introduction of these correlators, I guess, address that?
So I wouldn't say like there's an directly addressing the sign problem at all, even. I'm just saying that introducing these correlators, we think what it does is, because like if you take, for example, a deep neural network, in principle, it has the power to also and capture these correlators by training long enough. But by inputting these correlators, you kind of help it to a better start, like in your quantum state reconstruction paper, such that the training will be easier. And we think this is maybe what was helping also for the frustration. Okay. So now I talked a lot about lattice models and wave functions for that and neural networks for that. In the second part, I want to go away from it by reminding myself or us what a spin Hamiltonian actually is. And a spin Hamiltonian, if you don't have a quantum simulator, which actually is exactly the spin Hamiltonian, this also exists, but it's typically an effective Hamiltonian of, for example, a fermionic system. So you could have a Hubbard model, and then you would get effectively the antiferromagnetic Heisenberg model out of it through some super exchange. So if you go away from this approximation, you say, okay, if I want a full description, I need to look at fermionic systems. And one starting point would be fermionic systems on a lattice. There has been some development in that direction with different ansatzes. But also fermionic systems on a lattice, if you don't have ultra-cold atoms, it's not really what happens in nature, it's just an approximation. What actually happens is that you have some complicated system where all kinds of particles fly around, you have atoms, you have electrons, and they kind of do what they want. Now that's a huge mess. We didn't want to get into this huge mess. So we looked at a different type of approximation, and we looked at models that had a low energy description as kind of like a 2D electron gas. At least you only have electrons that you care about. Now, what kind of models are these? Well, recently there has been a lot of hype in creating correlated phases. So if you start with just an electron gas as you know it, like in 2D or 3D, with an isotropic Fermi surface, that's nice and all, but you know, like it's nice. If you want to get more exciting things, what people do is they start to create more complicated Fermi surfaces, right? And the very hyped thing to do that is by stacking stuff on top of each other. And that's all these graphene multilayer structures, for example, or other stuff where you have unconventional superconductivity, correlated phases, and so on and so on. Now, starting with graphene is not an easy starting point because you have all kinds of problems, trigonal warping, whatever. So we asked, okay, is there like a simpler model which still has interesting physics, which are not explained, correlated phases, but is easier to deal with? And what we looked at is a layered system which is an aluminium arsenide quantum well. And I'll explain why this is like cool and exciting in the next few slides, hopefully to convince you. So what is that? Well, people of you that are familiar with quantum dots will recognize the structure. It's basically the same, just with a different material. So what you have is like an aluminium arsenide layer, and then you have an aluminium gallium arsenide layer. And between these two layers, there will be a in low energy, there will be a 2D electron gas. And if we look at the Fermi surface of this 2D electron gas, what we have is a few things that are different to a standard electron gas. One is that the Fermi surface is not in the middle of the Brillouin zone, but at the edges. And we have like one Fermi surface in one direction and one in the other one. And if you take into account the periodicity of the system, it's really like this is one Fermi surface and this is one Fermi surface. And that's what we call a valley. And the electrons can occupy like spin up, spin down, and they here also can occupy valley 1 and valley 2. So this introduces an additional degree of freedom, a valley, and like with this you can do a lot of stuff, and I will mention it later. And the second thing is that the Fermi surface is not isotropic but anisotropic, and this brings you to an effective description of the problem as an electron gas with anisotropic masses and spin and valley degree of freedoms, and that's the Hamiltonian. So, okay, that's the system. Why is it interesting? And what's interesting depends on what kind of person you are. So, if you're a quantum device person, then you might say, okay, this is interesting because I have not only a spin, but I also have a valley, and I can use this valley to create, for example, a qubit or like valleytronics, whatever. So there are a lot of options there, and that's what people get excited about. If you're more a condensed matter theorist that gets excited about stuff like Wigner crystals, then you might say, oh, okay, we have like aluminium arsenide, which has a very large effective mass, which means that we have strong correlations for very accessible densities, and we could get like, you know, experimentally Wigner crystals in two dimensions. Oh, cool, let's look at this model. So, up to you. And having said that, okay, so that's the model, that's why it's cool. What are experimental results on it? So very recently, so last year, there was an experiment about this model, and what they found, and this is more in the direction of the quantum devices, is that you can control the valley occupation by tuning the density. So for low densities, there is a spontaneous valley polarization of the model, meaning that for large densities, the electrons occupy both valleys with spin up and spin down. And for small densities, they only occupy one with spin up and spin down. And this thing is like not theoretically understood. So we said, okay, what can we do? And the first starting point would be to say, okay, mean field. That's the easiest thing to do. Let's see whether we get some explanations of what happens using a mean field approach. So what we used is Hartree-Fock. And what's Hartree-Fock? Well, you approximate your state as a ground state of a non-interacting Hamiltonian. And here we say, you know, we're in the fluid phase, so we take like plane wave orbitals. And typically, you do all of this in K-space. I just write it like this because then it makes sense with the later connection. And then what's Hartree-Fock? Well, you just compute the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, and you minimize it. And why is it easy? Because you can compute this expectation value of the Hamiltonian efficiently because your ground state is non-interacting. And what you get is a kinetic energy and an exchange energy, and this part is basically just a density. And what it effectively does is to reshape your Fermi surface. So let's say that's your Fermi surface shaped by the kinetic energy. After doing Hartree-Fock, minimizing not only the kinetic energy, but also the exchange energy, makes like a repopulation of the K states. and you get a different Fermi surface. That's all. Very easy. We can do that. So we did it.
Sorry.
Yes?
Have people tried DFT on...
DFT on this? Not that I know of. Let's do it. I mean, it's also like, I mean, you could definitely do it, but it's also a kind of orthogonal direction, right? Because here you say, okay, you have mean feet, and then you go on from that. And in DFT, you would, you know, approximate your Hamiltonian kind of, and then find the solution of that. But like, yeah, it's like definitely a valid thing to ask. Okay, so if you do Hartree-Fock, what you get is the following. So these are the densities, and there is a transition from a symmetric state for high densities, good, that's also what we see in the experiment, to something that is degenerate, both spin polarized and value polarized. That's not good, because we only want value polarization, and then to something which is spin value polarized. Now, there are two problems with that. One is that we have never a phase where there's only a value polarized state with lowest energy, so it's not in accordance with the experiments, and it's way off. So the value polarization in the experiment is here. And the Hartree-Fock solution would tell us that this is deep, deep in the spin value polarized phase. So it doesn't really give us answers here, which means we need an approach beyond mean field. And one way to do that is to apply variational Monte Carlo for continuous systems. Now, what's variational Monte Carlo for continuous systems? You basically just construct a wave function in real space, and then you use the Hamiltonian in first quantization, and you sample through real space by moving the electrons around and minimize the energy. And how this wave function looks like, so there are a lot of different options, and the easiest thing, like first order thing to try, is to do the following, and to just take the mean field solution and apply in front of it a Jastrow factor. And this Jastrow factor, what it will do, what it should do, is to penalize if two electrons come close to each other. So it basically creates an exchange hole or a correlation hole. And if you look at this Jastrow factor, how it looks like is that you sum over all. So you can have like two-body, three-body, four-body, whatnot. The typical thing is that you say you take a two-body Jastrow factor, and you sum over all of the combinations between the electrons, and then you have a function here. And this function, how you parameterize it, that's what we use variational Monte Carlo for. So this function is some type of parameterization, can be, for example, a neural network, can be something different, and we use variational Monte Carlo to optimize the parameters of it to get, like, in effect, the shape of the exchange correlation. And you can do more sophisticated stuff, like you can input backflow correlations to change this part. You can put more than one selected determinant. Let's just keep with the simple first order thing. OK. And so before I come to the results, let's first think about what we would expect and what physically makes sense. In K-space, if we have the value polarized state, it means we have this Fermi surface, which is occupied once by spin up and once by spin down. If we have the spin polarized phase, we have this Fermi surface and this Fermi surface, and they're both occupied by spin up. Now, in real space, in a classical picture, the electrons will move around according to their kinetic energy and create like a cloud. So in real space, a spin up electron for the value polarized state will have such a cloud, and the spin down one will have the same cloud. And for the spin polarized state, one of the spin up electrons will have this cloud, and the one in the other valley will have the cloud rotated by 90 degrees. Okay. Now, okay, they are like moving around in their little clouds and trying to be happy.
So
yes.
The hole is now a real space.
Yes, it's rotated by 90 degrees because. Yes, it's a real space cloud.
It's a Fermi surface above.
It's the Fermi surface above, and it's the cloud below. Yeah, just the which is the larger mass gives you a different direction. And the only thing that these electrons will worry about is what happens if they meet another electron. So if the valley polarized electrons meet each other, they will want to create a hole. And both of them will want to create a hole that looks kind of like their cloud, right? So they do that, hopefully, and create like a hole that looks like the cloud that they are. In the spin polarized phase, it's not that easy because one electron will want a hole like this, and the other one will want a hole that is rotated by 90 degrees, so they have to find a compromise, which most likely will lead to like an energy that is paid to do that. Okay, so far like intuition, you could say, no, that's not my intuition, whatever. But that's like the intuition, the simple intuition if you look at this problem. Now we can do variation Monte Carlo and see what happens. And doing variation Monte Carlo, we can actually plot these exchange correlation holes. And if we do that, we find that they exactly look like we predicted. So these are really the just refactor between the two valleys or the two spins, and they look anisotropic or isotropic. And if we have a look at the energies, we see indeed that there is a splitting between the valley polarized and the spin polarized state. So we have an energy gain through this creation of the correlation hole, which is anisotropic, and it explains part of what we couldn't explain using Hartree-Fock. Now, this is something we're still working on, so it's not done. What's missing is the following part. Like it's not completely missing, but partly missing. So if you look at the relevant density regime, where in the experiment the valley polarization happens, and you plot the Hartree-Fock results versus the variation Monte Carlo results, you see this. So that's the Hartree-Fock results, symmetric state, spin polarized, valley polarized, and spin valley polarized. And that's the spin polarized and valley polarized state, which have a very small energy difference, like way smaller than the Hartree-Fock solutions with each other. So that's one issue. Okay, the energy difference is so small, you need very accurate numerics. And the second one is that you could say, okay, but here we have still a spin valley polarized state. What happens with it? It looks like it would get a much lower energy, right? But what actually happens is that both this state and this state get an energy gain through variation Monte Carlo, which puts them along this line, like very, very close. And it makes a lot of sense because this is the regime where the phase transitions happen. So there are small energy differences and that's what happens. But it means that you need like proper finite size scaling and so on to actually decipher what if we have like a stable valley polarized phase and what's the phase diagram and so on and so on. And that's something that we're still working on. And just to mention it, so there are like different things that could also happen. And one is a Wigner crystal. So for small densities, we know that at some point the electrons will crystallize. So if the density is very small, then the Coulomb energy in comparison to the kinetic energy is very large. So what the electrons will want to do is just stay at one position as far away from each other as possible. And the Wigner crystal should kick in somewhere here. So what you actually should do is do the variation Monte Carlo again with different orbitals, which are kind of Gaussian orbital shapes, such that it looks like a Wigner crystal, and see whether you get a smaller energy here. And that's also tricky because, you know, you don't know exactly how this Wigner crystal would look, and the accuracy will be different than for the fluid phase. So there is a lot of stuff that can go wrong. And a thing that I want to mention is that in principle, so we are just in the middle of the project, so that's not done yet, but it seems like an ideal test bed to test some machine learning approaches because the energy differences are so small that it actually could make a difference if your ansatz is more expressible. Or you could say, okay, let's try to find a phase transition using a machine learning method. But that's all for the future. For now, what we did find is the splitting of the spin polarized and the valley polarized state, and the rest we're still looking at. So with this, let me conclude the second part. So as a main thing, also from this last slide, is what you see is that mean field for strongly correlated phases really doesn't make much sense, because it completely something different happens actually than in the Hartree-Fock picture. So what one needs is methods beyond mean field. And variation Monte Carlo is one option. And using that, what we could find is that the value polarization for the case of aluminium arsenide is explainable through correlation effects. And for the complete phase diagram, there are a lot of questions. So thanks very much for your attention. And if you have any questions, of course, I'm happy to answer them.
Sorry, in the VMC, was the correlation function, or whatever it's called, was that parameterized with the neural network here?
Is that here not, no. What we used is, it could be, what we used is some kind of spline interpolation with polynomials. But, like, I don't think it's a very smart parameterization. I used it because in the package I was using, it was already implemented. But if you think about it, so what it is you basically have your difference between the positions, and you have a function that is a function of the difference. And then this piecewise interpolation has different parameters for each like sector of R, let's say. And if you do Monte Carlo sampling, you know, you might not have samples for all of these differences, and then not all of the parameters might get trained the same way. So I don't think that's the smartest ansatz to take.
Agnes, did you say, can you go back to the two slides over here, this guy? Did you say that in the Hartree-Fock case, so the spin polarized and value polarized, the difference between both of them was larger than, or sorry, was smaller than in the variation Monte Carlo case, the equivalent to?
No. So like here, they are exactly degenerate in Hartree-Fock, so there's no difference.
Right.
What I'm saying is, like, if you look at these differences,
okay.
It's a huge difference. And what we get are tiny, tiny differences, which means you need a very high accuracy.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, technical question. So when you have this mean field state plus the Jastrow, do you re-optimize the fermionic part, or do you what it was?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So it's not that simple to re-optimize the Slater part because it's discrete. I'm not even sure if this can be done. Like, at least I didn't see a paper doing that. What we did do is try different Fermi surfaces. It is not the mean field solution, but adjacent to it, and then see which one gets the lowest.
Sorry, so what do you mean by optimizing the Slater part?
So what you find in the, I mean, that's a product, right? So, and these will be just k-space occupations. And the k-space occupations you find through Hartree-Fock. And right now what we're optimizing is just the parameters in the Jastrow factor.
I think, I mean, at least on the lattice, we know how. The equal and so on. When I was a PhD student, I learned how to do it, but in the continuum, I don't remember.
How do you do it on the lattice again?
So you optimize, so you you use the mean field Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
And,
but this with a Jastrow factor?
On top, yeah.
On top, okay. I see. Yeah, maybe you could do that as well. I didn't find a paper doing it, but maybe you can actually, you can
I'm
do
not
it.
Sure the continuum, but yeah. The lattice.
Yeah, I see. I mean, if nothing, you can also, you know, put like a multi-determinant, and then you will have an automatic. I mean, yeah, I would check.
Questions online?
Yeah, I can answer another question.
Yes.
What, so you have two Hamiltonians, right? You have the low energy that you had in the
yes.
right? And this one, right? Are they?
I mean, these are the same one. Like, this is the same as the other Hamiltonian. Just I actually have, you have some density on top of it because it's a Yalium-Delium model, but it's the same Hamiltonian. Just in first quantization and second quantization. Yes?
Is you kind of just added more visible units, right,
mm-hmm.
for that model to be correlation functions?
Mm-hmm.
Like during your sampling, did you was there a way that you like enforced the correlation actual like one? Or like the actual that you sampled?
No. I mean, it's an interesting point, but because we don't input like the correlation like expectation value, but just the product. So what you really do is, you know, you take the spin configuration that you sampled, and then you just compute the correlators from that. So it's always consistent with the sample. But I mean, it would be an interesting idea to see what happens if you, you know, compute expectation values on top of it, and then do this, put this into your ansatz.
One more question.
Yes.
You mentioned that when you have like this for or VMC sign problem that you were talking about, what I guess, yeah, because I've seen it in a couple of places where they're like, okay, there's a sign problem, then there's a glossy optimization landscape, and then it's hard.
Yeah.
But then there are some people who are like, there's no glossy optimization, but it's still hard. Like, I don't know if you know, you know anything about that. Like, I've never heard as the VMC sign problem, but I think it's interesting.
Yeah, it's, I think one, for example, knows a lot of this because they had a paper. I'm not completely sure what's right now state of the art with the optimization landscape. Like, I mean, for sure there are papers. There's, for example, a paper which tries to reconstruct states from frustrated Hamiltonians from ED, where it shouldn't be like an issue with the variation Monte Carlo optimization landscape, but they still get worse results for frustrated systems. So it's something more involved than that, for sure.
Then I have another kind of abstract question. You showed these pictures of like your Hilbert space growing as you increase parameters, but then I feel like by, you know, in principle, sure, be growing that way, but it feels like that there's tension between that statement and then these like universal approximation statements. Do you know if there have been studies that show that maybe you just need an exponential? I mean, I guess in principle that could always be a possibility.
I mean, like you can always approximate it, right?
Right.
You would just need an exponential amount of parameters.
Yeah.
And that's not what you want in variational Monte Carlo. But you're right, so like this is just something empirically, basically, what I was showing. So,
right.
You know, I was looking at the Torrey code. I tried the RBM. I increased the amount of hidden units as much as I can.
Okay, I see.
And not much happened.
Okay. Yeah.
But with an exponential amount, it would work, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Sorry, one.
Yes.
It's about the triangular lattice. Do you use complex?
Yeah.
And do you remember what's the number in front of the three body? Or like, is it a real or imaginary? The three body part of your correlation?
Ah, you mean like if the weight of this is real or imaginary?
Yeah.
Ah, I think it was real, but I'm not completely sure. Like it could, no, it could also be something different. No, I'm not just saying something. I don't know.
No,
so, but I could look it up.
Yeah. I think they put a complex number. And
ah, yeah, yeah. So they put an I and something. Yeah, okay, this I have. Yeah, yeah.
Ah, so
there's an I.
Okay,
yeah,
then,
yeah. Sorry.
Real and then
yeah. Now I remember.
Because I remember they had some intuition, but.
Yeah, so why? What's the story?
I don't remember the story, but.
Yeah, they had some intuition about, so they separated it, so they initialized part of the wave function in the classical Neel state, And then you need the eye for the spin to change orientation. And that was basically the intuition.
Right.
Yeah. But that's not for the three body, I think. I think this is sufficient already for the one spin thing, like with one spin.
Ah, I see.
And then you have the imaginary part.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then they just did like the two body and the three body and just minimized that. But this, I don't know if it was imaginary, the coefficients in front of the...
I remember there was some...
Yeah, there was the imaginary part because of the Neil state.
Nice. Well, thank you.
Thank you as well.